You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, October 26th. I keep wanting to say Thursday. I'm not sure what that is. Anyway, my pleasure to be back with you. And looking forward to my guest here in about 15 minutes, Dr. Susan Neiman, who is a moral philosopher. She'll be talking to us. She's an American, but she currently lives in Berlin, Germany. She's the head of the Einstein Forum. She also teaches in an academic setting. But has written a great piece in the Religion and Ethics, ABC Religion and Ethics, not the American Broadcasting Company. I think it's Australian, actually, ABC. But anyway, she wrote, a very interesting piece on the Book of Job and what she advocates for a philosophical reading of the Book of Job, and makes the contention that Western philosophy does not begin with Plato. Or the other Greek philosophers, but elsewhere and earlier with the Book of Job and the whole fundamental question of what seems to be inexplicable suffering and how we deal with it. Is the universe, does it have any meaning at all? So we'll look forward to that conversation with her coming up here in about 15 minutes. Our question of the day, kind of a fun one, inspired by my birthday celebration with our 22-year-old daughter last night. What is your preferred birthday dessert? 573-4BREAD-4. Doesn't have to be cake, by the way. You can break tradition. Somebody wants to know, what is your preferred birthday dessert? What would you say? Give me a shout, 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, mikeallenshow@gmail.com, or you can post your thought on Facebook or on Twitter. Other things we'll get into during this hour, hopefully the different looks of love. More wackiness from Genesis and the abortion/seamless garment question, all coming up later in the program. We'll also spin the Dial of Catechism wheel, as we do at the end of every show. I was sharing a little bit earlier in the first hour from the prayer journals of Flannery O'Connor, the great writer of Southern Gothic literature in many ways. The Catholic, she died very young, and how we are blessed, or I picked up this book thanks to my friend Donna over at our Catholic bookstore. Let me know about this book that came in, a used book called A Prayer Journal of Flannery O'Connor, in which it has not only the text of different prayers that she's written, who enjoyed offering her prayers with the pen, somebody who's a writer that shouldn't surprise us, but also we even see photos of her journal writings, very honest in her own journey and struggle of prayer. As I've shared before, a great quote from her journals here on the back, "Dear God, I cannot love thee the way I want to. You are the slim crescent of a moon that I see, and myself is the earth's shadow that keeps me from seeing all the moon. I do not know you, God, because I am in the way. Please help me to push myself aside." I just love that imagery, that I am the one blocking myself, my own shadow is keeping me from you. I think anyone who's ever struggled with prayer knows exactly what she means. But back into this prayer reflection that she wrote about the whole issue of supplication in prayer and learning to ask for what would be most beneficial to her and to others, not simply for what she wants. But she, as we last hour concluded, she had been told about the Monsignor who said that it was the business of reason, not emotion, the love of God. The emotion would be a help. But Flannery O'Connor writes, "I realized last time that it would be a selfish one. Oh, dear God, the reason is very empty. I suppose mine is also lazy, but I want to get near you. yet it seems almost a sin to suggest such a thing even. You read here her yearning for intimacy with God, of which prayer really is a foundational expression. And then she says this, I think it's very interesting. Perhaps communion doesn't give the nearness, I mean. Wow. I mean, the communion, which is the Eucharist, the source and summit of the faith, it's the source from which God's grace flows. It is the summit to which we aspire. But she writes, perhaps communion doesn't give the nearness I mean. The nearness I mean comes after death, perhaps. It is what we are struggling for, and if I found it, either I would be dead or I would have seen it for a second and life would be intolerable. I don't know about this or anything. It sounds juvenile, my saying anything so obvious. It's fascinating what she says there about communion. You know, communion is, the Eucharist is Christ's real presence, body, blood, soul, and divinity. We're not encountering a symbol of him. And yet he is veiled. He's veiled to the senses. He's veiled under the appearance of bread and wine. And therefore, the Eucharist, in a sense, is a bittersweet. Because whereas we know through our reason that we are encountering our Lord, whose words are performative, they change things. And therefore, when the priest in the person of Christ says, "This is my body," bread and wine become transubstantiated, transformed into his very real presence. This is why we worship the Eucharist. It's really him. And so we can know via our reason and occasionally the consolations of the heart that when we receive that host or when we drink of the cup, we are experiencing union with him, though it is veiled from our senses. And what it creates in us, though, is a yearning for the veil to be removed. Because the glory of heaven, of course, please God, should we be there in that communion of life and love with the Holy Trinity and the beatific vision and seeing God face to face. There are no sacraments in heaven. Because the sacrament is a sign that points to, in heaven, we will be, with veil removed, in complete and intimate union with the one for whom our hearts were made. And so even in communion, there is a satisfaction, but there's an almost deepening of the hunger. But I like her second point. If I found it, either I would be dead or I would have seen it for a second and life would be intolerable. Perhaps there is a mercy in the fact that God withholds the fullness of his presence from us during this sojourn in this valley of tears, because to taste of it in its fullness would make life here intolerable, insufferable, because of our yearning for him. So, great book, and I'll be going back and forth to this a little bit in the weeks ahead. Flannery O'Connor, a little window into her own prayer life. Gives me a little hope, too, because I struggle with prayer. So, but God, thank God, he is a patient and a faithful teacher. St. Paul, yesterday, we waded into the first reading, Ephesians 5. Very challenging word on marital politics, the whole idea of wives submitting to their husbands as to the Lord, husbands loving wives as Christ loved the church. He continues in that vein into chapter 6 in his letter to the Ephesians. Now remember, of course, the chapter divisions in the biblical books are artificial. Doesn't mean they don't help us structure and order the text, but they were not placed there by the authors. And so St. Paul simply transitions. He ends chapter 4 and in chapter 5 about what it means to be imitators of God as beloved children, which, as I said, provokes one of my personal mentors and heroes of the faith to chuckle. He says, "St. Paul, have you lost your mind? How can we imitate God who is omniscient and omnipresent and omnipotent? We imitate God, as St. Paul says, by walking in love. We are most like God when we love, when we forgive, when we are kind, when we let bitterness and wrath drift away. But there's a specificity to what love looks like based on our station in life, the different looks of love. And that's what we get at the end of Ephesians chapter 5 and the whole language about husbands and wives and equal in dignity, both called to love, both called to a mutual submission, but it looks differently in each case. Chapter 6 continues the same thing. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother. This is the first commandment with a promise that it may be well with you and that you may live long on the earth. Fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. So we can see that love looks differently in each case and in each person. This is why it's been said before, and I happen to agree, that the phrase WWJD is not that helpful, because there was one Jesus. Yes, he lives in and through us, but the question is, what would Jesus have me do? What will love look like? What will his mercy and holiness look like in my particular vocation as a child, as a parent, as a husband and wife? St. Paul with some words worth reflecting on. We'll be back on the other side of the break. We'll be talking to Dr. Susan Niemann, director of the Einstein Forum in Germany, also a professor of moral philosophy in Berlin. We'll be talking about Job as philosophy's beginning. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on Breadbox Media on this Wednesday, October 26th. We are blessed to have with us, live from Berlin, Germany, Dr. Susan Niemann, who is a moral philosopher and the director of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Germany, originally from Atlanta, Georgia. She's the author of Evil in Modern Thought, Moral Clarity, A Guide for Grown-Up Idealists, and most recently, Why Grow Up? Subversive Thoughts for an Infantile Age. We're talking about the article that she has published in the ABC Religion and Ethics website on a philosophical reading of the book of Job, The Rationality of the World. Dr. Niemann, hello.
Hello, Mike.
Great to have you with us, and great to
talk to be here
to an American expat over in Berlin.
Yes, that's what I am.
Well, and you are, we talked about this a little bit on email, your faith background is Jewish.
I'm Jewish, that's right.
Yeah, fantastic. We are talking about the book of Job. You argue in your piece here that philosophy, Western philosophy, does not begin, as many often contend, with Plato, Aristotle, with the Greek philosophers, but with the book of Job. Why do you say that?
Well, I think the book of Job is asking the most important question that leads anybody seriously into philosophy, which is namely, how can we live in a world with so much unexplained evil? Does that question the meaning of life? How are we to understand that? And I think that's the question really that philosophy begins with.
Yeah, you summarize the problem of evil very succinctly. You know, if you have these three sentences, God exists and is omnipotent, God exists and is benevolent, and then evil exists. How do we reconcile the three? I guess this is what we call the classical theodicy question. But one
and I think it's actually impossible to reconcile it. You have to drop one of the sentences.
Hmm.
You cannot hold all three of those. So one of the most classic ways to deal with that was to say, and still is, well, evil doesn't really exist. Things that we think are evil are going to turn out to be good in the end. You can't have light without shadow. You wouldn't want to eat sweets all day and nothing salty. These are examples that the philosopher Leibniz used. But they're things that you find all the time. And, you know, while they may work in cases of minor evils, it's very, very hard to reconcile them with murder, with you know, the death of a child, or the unfair honors and riches that sometimes happen to people who we know or really don't deserve them. On the contrary, you know, horrible people sometimes do very well in this earth. Now, it is, of course, the other classical answer, and this is just a way of in a way, saying that evils don't exist is saying, well, but there is an afterlife, and in the afterlife, everybody who was good will be infinitely rewarded, and everybody who was bad will go to hell. And as the great Christian author, who, although I'm not a Christian, I've been very much influenced by C.S. Lewis, said, you know, this is just not, it's not an possible answer. First of all, it pushes the question just further back. And secondly, there's too much that we don't know about an afterlife. So this is not an acceptable answer.
Would you say, Dr. Niemann, that the book of Job, though, seeks to hold those three truths together in a sort of tension? In other words, and certainly I think I would say classic Christian theodicy doesn't seek to abandon either of the three, but tries to make sense of how they can be held together, even as seemingly irrational on the surface as it appears to be.
I think that's true, except that I think that what tends to have to happen, and you do actually have traditional Christian theology. I mean, Calvin, right, basically denied the second premise that God is benevolent.
At least to all persons, right? I mean, he said God loves some but not others.
Correct, correct. It's interesting that Calvin wrote many, many sermons on the book of Job himself. So the right interpretation of the book of Job is why it makes for such fascinating reading. And, you know, people have been arguing about this for centuries in all three Western religions. He plays a big role.
It's really one of the great books of Christian Western literature, isn't it, in many ways?
Totally. Totally. It's it just is one of the one, and I think it's a great book of literature, but I also think it's a great book of philosophy, and it's where philosophy ought to start. And that's basically where I start in my book, Evil in Modern Thought. But you know what? I don't want to claim to have the definitive interpretation of the book of Job when, you know, what makes a book like that so great is precisely the fact that it's very rich and it's open to a number of interpretations. But this is the way that I read it, and I do think it manages to reconcile in some way those propositions. But one does have to give up the idea that God is omnipotent. Okay, and this is actually, there's something in Jewish thought, not all of Jewish thought, but there is a tradition that says God made the world and he expected us to continue to improve it. And, you know, there's work to be done. So this is how I read God saying at the end of the book of Job, Job was right and not the friends of Job. And everybody's always very puzzled by God's answer. It's the longest speech of God anywhere in the Bible. It's very long. It's very beautiful. And it completely doesn't answer Job's question. Job's question, by the way, is not why me? Why is this awful? why are these awful things happening to me? It's, why is there injustice in the world? He starts by saying, why me? Why am I suffering this injustice? But he goes on to say, he gives all kinds of other examples of injustice in the world. The rich people are sitting back in their gardens watching their grandchildren skip like lambs. Poor people are working very hard for them and don't even have enough to eat. I mean, it can be quite contemporary, actually. And Job asks those questions, and God doesn't answer them at all. What he does is to give a description of the world that he created and to say, you know, this is what I've done, you know, period. So you're left with a puzzle. Is God just saying, shut up here, I'm the boss, which some people have interpreted the book as saying. But then if you look at the very end, God says, well, Job has spoken the truth about me. Now, how can this be? And my understanding is Job is talking about justice. He's talking about the way the world should be, right? Where God talked about the way the world is. And those are two very different things. And the way the world should be, a question of justice, is a human question, and one that's left for us to settle. This is my reading.
Mm. Yeah, the three friends have not been treated well by critics over the years. You know, they're very, you know, in their mind, which is not at all an inappropriate response. You try to make sense of things. There has to be a rationality to the universe, as you've said, you know, if
well, we want the universe right. to be rational,
and so therefore
but
there has to be some there has
yeah.
to be some reason, therefore, for Job's suffering. But the fact that Job, you know, even rages against God, he is not condemned for, which I guess should give us some hope as well.
Well, it's not that he's not condemned for it. God rewards him in the end, not only by giving him back the things that he's lost, but much more importantly by saying, you've spoken the truth about me, not the friends. And that's a really fascinating statement. We have to say why the friends, you know, what is it that the friends were not speaking the truth about? Well, they were trying to find reason in the world. Reason isn't found in the world. Reason is something that we have to put into the world by making as much sense of it as we can, by making it a more just place. But it wasn't created as a thing of justice. That's just not how it works.
Is there any possibility to the idea, you know, that yes, the three truths there, right? God is omnipotent, God is benevolent, and that evil exists, that God is chosen in a manner through human freedom to restrain his omnipotence, which is real, but he allows human beings the freedom and with all the consequence that comes with that.
You know, this was Augustine's answer to the problem of evil, and I don't find it very satisfying because, and the great philosopher Pierre Bayle, already in the late 17th century, answered this. He said, "Well, then it's like it's a little risque example, but I think it's very appropriate." He says, consider a mother who doesn't want her daughter to go to a ball because she knows she'll lose her virginity there. And, of course, in those days, it meant being a total social outcast and everything.
Dr. Neiman, we are unfortunately out of time, and our music is cranked up there for the end of the break. We have these hard breaks, so I really apologize for that. Thanks for taking time to be with us, and thanks for your good work.
You are welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Blessings. Bye-bye. We'll be back in a minute with more. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
We'll be right back. right at the bottom of the hour back on the Mike Allen Show here on Redbox Media. You want to know more of what we're about at Redbox Media, or you want to listen to podcasts of different programs, get to know some of our different show hosts, you can do it all at redboxmedia.com or subscribe to podcasts through Google Play, iTunes, or Podbean. You can also download the Redbox Media app. Highly recommend it. My wife was telling me the other day, she said, you know, I didn't realize how easy it is. I thought, man, you ought to make a plug for Redbox Media. She said, I got the app. I thought I was going to, every time I listen, have to go through some sort of, you know, rigmarole gatekeeper sort of thing. She said, all I have to do is touch on it on my smartphone, the little icon, and I'm listening. So it's great. You got Redbox Media in your pocket. So anyway, great ways to discover what we're about. You can become a friend of your favorite show. Nudge, nudge, hint, hint, wink, wink. I'm blushing. If you want to support the show and you help it remain going strong, you can do that too as well. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to call or text into the program, or you can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. You can post a thought on Facebook or Twitter. My question of the day, after having a nice birthday dinner last night with our 22-year-old daughter, we had chocolate cake and ice cream after the classic birthday dessert. But if you had your birthday dessert of choice, what would it be? And no, you don't have to limit yourself to cake. So love to hear from you on that. 573-4BREAD-4. Really wish we'd had more time with Dr. Susan Neiman, head of the Einstein Forum in Potsdam, Germany, though Atlanta, Georgia native. She's lost that Georgia accent, though, for sure. But fascinating, I think. I love talking to people. Particularly, I love talking to the Jewish people about the Old Testament, because I think they have their own particular perspective and a rootedness in the text from their own tradition that I think brings a lot of enlightenment. And yet, at the same time, you know, I'm sure over a cup of coffee or something, we could have a nice extended conversation. I wouldn't say an argument, but certainly a dialogue about the book of Job and the problem of evil. And I think in some ways, perhaps, what it illustrates, the book of Job, a very ancient book, a book that has provoked much conversation over many centuries. I remember my first real encounter with the book of Job was in an AP English class my senior year in high school in a public school. We were supposed to read the book of Job as literature. Here she's reading the book of Job as philosophy and trying to make sense of it. You know, the basic idea, right? Job's this innocent man looked upon with great pleasure by God. The accuser, Satan, appears in the heavenly courts, and Job is lifted up as the exemplar of virtue. And Satan, the accuser, says the only reason he's devoted to you is because you're so protecting of him. He's got a hedge about him. No evil befalls him. He's got his health. He's got his money. He's got his family. If these things were to be stripped from him, then what would he do? I'm reminded of a billboard I saw many, many, many years ago. All it was in a very stark white background with what looked like charring around the outskirts, like it had been burned. And all it said in simple text on what remained on the billboard there of the white text surrounded by the charring effect, when all that's left is your insurance. And I remember immediately making the connection in my mind, what if we said, when all that's left is your faith, when everything else has been stripped away, which is what it was with Job, then what do you do? And It raises the question, as Dr. Neiman so artfully explains in her article, which is linked through my show's blog, MikeAllenShow.blogspot.com. I'll try to put a direct link on the show's Facebook page as well. She reads it very much as a philosophical treatise on this question, and really how to reconcile the suffering that we experience in the world, what seems to be the irrationality of pain and of evil, almost the capricious nature of it, and the fact that we believe in a God who is a God of reason, a God who creates, a God who is just, and a God who is good and all-powerful. How do we reconcile these three precepts, that God exists and is omnipotent, that God exists and is benevolent, and that evil exists. And we got cut off because of our automatically time breaks, but, you know, she was talking about this whole question, or I raised this whole question of where does our freedom fit in? Because she was arguing you have to compromise on one of the three, whereas I think the classic Christian theodicy is you don't. God, yes, does exist and is omnipotent. However, he has chosen, in a sense, to restrain his omnipotence by giving us space in the universe to be morally free creatures. He's still sovereign, of course, but he allows us freedom, and human freedom is the source of great suffering. It is. And so we can continue to affirm that God exists and is omnipotent, God exists and is benevolent, and the fact that evil exists with the fact that God is love, and love by its very nature is free. And therefore freedom not only brings great opportunity for love and joy, but also great freedom for anguish and pain, the freedom to hurt one another. And I think she was, I'm not familiar with the analogy that St. Augustine was talking about. She said a mother whose daughter, she knows if she goes to the ball, is going to lose her virginity, yet she chooses to let her go anyway. It's not that her mother willed for her daughter to fall into sin, but it was her will that made it possible. And this is kind of the situation we're in. I think at the end of the day, and you can read Dr. Niemann's article for yourself, because I do think it's a very in-depth piece that really treats the book of Job with great respect. And I think is also at the same time very honest in the complexities of the book of Job. It's really, I think, a great analytical, philosophical piece. But I think at the end of the day, in my view, as a Catholic Christian, that to try to grasp, to try to enter into, to try to come to grips and to terms with the problem of evil, apart from the passion of Christ, apart from the fact that God, in taking on flesh, chose to enter into the suffering of this world, is, I think, unsatisfying. I think it is only when we understand suffering in light of the cross that we can find any sense of peace and resolution at all. Maybe it's not the answer we want, because God chooses to overcome and to defeat suffering, not by eradicating it, but by entering into it and receiving it unto himself and finding resurrection on the other side and inviting us really to do the same thing. Inviting us to take up our own cross. I'm kind of reminded a little bit of the movie. Have you seen the movie Signs? It's a fascinating film, right? Mel Gibson is, and his brother, played by Joaquin Phoenix, and there's this whole phenomenon of these aliens that are getting ready to invade the Earth. They're sort of at this point hovering above the Earth. People are seeing it throughout the world. It's all over CNN, ABC News. They're all watching it on TV. People wonder what's going to happen when these aliens land. What are their intentions? Are they nefarious? Are they friendly? And so forth. And there's this great scene where Mel Gibson and Joaquin Phoenix, the two brothers, Mel Gibson, a former Episcopal priest who lost his faith after the death of his wife, and Joaquin Phoenix, his younger brother, they're sitting there watching TV. It's dark. All the kids are asleep. They're sitting there on the couch watching coverage of these fascinating lights of these extraterrestrial vehicles hovering in the sky. Joaquin Phoenix's character Meryl says, some people are probably thinking this is the end of the world. And then he says to his brother, played by Mel Gibson, Graham, do you think it's a possibility? Mel Gibson's character says, yes. Meryl says, how can you say that? Graham says, that wasn't the answer you wanted. And Meryl says, can you at least to pretend to be like you used to be? Give me some comfort. Graham says, there are all different ways you could tell that there's someone really there watching out for us. You see signs. Sometimes they're little ones. You think of someone. The phone rings. They're on the phone. Sometimes they're big, like 14 lights hovering over Mexico City. Sure, there are lots of people watching this who think this could be a bad thing, but there are lots of people watching this who think it's a miracle, a sign of God's existence. It's all in how you look at things, Meryl. What you have to decide is what kind of person you are. Are you the type who believes in miracles and looks for signs? Or are you the kind who believes things just happen by chance? We'll be back with more on the other side of the break. That's the issue we have to deal with when we're in the face of evil. Is there some meaning at all? That's what I think Dr. Susan Neiman has raised an important question. Why Job is the beginning of philosophy. We need the world to make sense. I think from the Christian perspective, it only makes sense through the cross. We'll be back in a minute. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes before the top of the hour, you're back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Wednesday, October 26th. If you've got anything to say, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text my email, mikeallenshow@gmail.com. Our question of the day is, what is your preferred birthday dessert? I've had several answers. Bonnie just sent an email. My mom always made me a delicious homemade German chocolate cake. Wow, Bonnie, you got me hungry for one now. Good choice. She also throws in there, she's a sports fan, she's cheering for the Tribe. Go Indians, trying to make it the year of Cleveland. Like I said, the Browns didn't get the memo. Anyway, yeah, it's Cubs could be in trouble. We'll see. We'll see. They win game two, though, and it's back on like Donkey Kong. We were talking a little bit about, we've been talking about the book of Job, the problem of suffering, the problem of evil, trying to come up with, trying to discern a rationality to the universe that if we were to determine has no reason at all would be unbearable, to be honest with you. And I was telling you a little bit about from the movie Signs. I think part of the script I was reading you made was the original script, not what actually made it into the dialogue of the film. Because in the film, if you've seen it, this M. Night Shyamalan, before he started making really bad movies, this Signs, I love Mel Gibson, who plays this former Episcopal priest who's lost his faith. His brother, played by Joaquin Phoenix, Mel Gibson's character named Graham, Joaquin's Meryl. They live together in this farmhouse, and they're dealing with this reality of a potential alien invasion of the world. They've encountered the strange creatures out in their cornfield, and they discovered that this is a worldwide phenomenon, that there are these spaceships hovering above the Earth in all kind of different locales across the globe, and it's being covered by TV, and people are wondering what's going to happen. There's going to be some sort of visitation. Is it going to be good or bad? And late at night, Mel Gibson and his brother are watching TV, lights are out. They're seeing the coverage of these strange lights. And Mel Gibson, when asked by his brother Meryl, what he thought about this situation, says people break down into two groups when they experience something lucky. Group number one sees it as more than luck, more than coincidence. They see it as a sign, evidence that there's someone up there watching out for them. Group number two sees it as just pure luck, a happy turn of chance. He said, I'm sure the people in group number one are looking at those lights in a very suspicious way. For them, the situation isn't, it could be bad, it could be good. But deep down, they feel that whatever happens, they're on their own. Situation is 50-50, is what he said. And that fills them with fear. But there's a whole lot of people in group number one, and when they see those lights, they're looking at a miracle. And deep down, they feel that whatever's going to happen, there will be someone there to help them. And that fills them with hope. This is where Joaquin Phoenix jumps in and says he's a miracle guy himself. He sees signs. He sees miracles. Kind of a funny story from his youth. He says, I'm a miracle man. Those lights are a miracle. Then he asks Mel Gibson, the former Episcopal priest who's lost his faith, which type are you? Are you the type number one or type number two? Mel Gibson then goes on to talk about the very thing that made him lose his faith, the death of his wife in a tragic automobile accident, and the things that she said just before she died that in Mel Gibson's mind were nonsensical. They were random. They were just nerve endings in her brain firing as she died. And then in, I think, one of the darkest moments, maybe in certainly this film, maybe in cinematic history, across the darkness, Mel Gibson looks at his brother with half of his light illumined by the television on before them and says, there is no one watching out for us, Meryl. We are all on our own. I mean, that's the question, right? That's the question I think Job seeks to answer, a philosophical reading in the face of suffering, of unimaginable suffering. Do we believe in the irrationality of the universe, that there is no one who is our advocate, that there is no one who is in control? We are simply this orb hurtling through this vast emptiness. And therefore, to even talk about good and evil is really nonsensical. It has no meaning. So that's just the rub. It's when you begin to question why evil happens that it therefore pushes you into the dilemma of how do you even define what good and evil are. The very fact that there's something in you, some echo of the way things should be, that resonates within you, that points you to a creator, that points you to a benevolent God, a God of justice. And you question not so much whether God exists, but why, what type of God he is, and why he allows it. That's really the issue that comes to the forefront in Job. This is the issue, as I said, that I don't think you can make sense of apart from the cross, but it is in the cross that you see that God himself, when he entered into the human condition to save us, when he took on flesh, assumed a human nature, he did not exempt himself from the darkness of this world and from what seems to be the irrationality of humanity executing the true innocent man. But instead, he received it to himself. He absorbed the darkness into himself. And the resurrection, which is the hinge point on which the whole thing turns through the resurrection, has overcome it. And he invites us to be united with him in our suffering that we might find joy on the other side. Apart from the cross, as beautiful and poignant as the book of Job is, I think it leaves us with a bit of an aftertaste, because only in Jesus Christ do we see the full hope in the midst of that. It's tough. I saw my friend yesterday who's dying of cancer, and it's, you know, leaving behind a wife and loving children, and he himself much too young. You wonder why. Why, God? But even in that why, that's where God shows up. And it's in him that we place our hope. If you've got a comment, 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. There was another piece I wanted to get to today, but alas, I got caught up in this question that Job provokes. That's the beautiful thing of, God willing, me having a daily show. That means we can talk about it tomorrow. It's this question of whether this idea of a seamless garment or a consistent ethic of life means going soft on abortion, which is often the argument. Those who say, look, I can't vote for Hillary Clinton because of her all-in support of abortion, almost zeal for abortion. But at the same time, Donald Trump has so many problematic things, not only in his conduct, but even in his policies that are anti-life, despite his contention of being now pro-life. My belief in a consistent ethic of life means I can't vote for Donald Trump. And the accusation immediately becomes, then you must not care about babies or about abortion, because it's the only issue that counts. Charles Camosi, who I think is really one of the great minds, thinkers on the issue of ethics, talks about this very issue in a Crux Now piece that I'll get to tomorrow. But he argues that a consistent ethic of life does not mean going soft on abortion, but understanding that, like a Jenga puzzle, the truths of the faith are intertwined and cannot be separated without undercutting the stability of the whole thing. Speaking of that, that leads us to Dial a Catechism, because this game is rooted in the very belief that truth is not random and integrated within the panoramic totality of the faith. So we go to random.org, our random number generator. We dial up a number between 1 and 2865, 2498. So we'll be, I think, in the, let's see, yeah, in the moral life, 2498. This is under the section about the use of social communications media. Civil authorities have particular responsibilities in this field because of the common good. It is for the civil authority to defend and safeguard a true and just freedom of information. By promulgating laws and overseeing their application, public authorities should ensure that public morality and social progress are not gravely endangered through misuse of the media. Civil authorities should punish any violation of the rights of individuals to their reputation and privacy. They should give timely and reliable reports concerning the general good or respond to the well-founding concerns of the people. Nothing can justify recourse to disinformation for manipulating public opinion through the media. Interventions by public authority should avoid injuring the freedom of individuals or groups. So it holds up in this paragraph really the twin goods of the freedom of information, the freedom of speech, as well as the responsibility that comes with that freedom, not to practice calumny or not to practice libel, for example, and not to use that freedom to manipulate. Journalists should see in themselves a sacred responsibility to communicate the truth and to advocate for the common good. I think our journalists, our media, would do well to take this paragraph to heart, particularly during this election season. We'll be back by God's grace tomorrow. Hope you have a great rest of your day. This is the Mike Allen Show. You've been listening to Breadbox Media.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.